You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
When Rivka Galchen's debut novel, Atmospheric Disturbances, was published 6 years ago, critics compared her to Borges, Kafka, and Pynchon. And now Ms. Galchen has turned those comparisons inside out in American Innovations, her new collection of short stories, in which she reimagines classics by some of literature's most distinguished male writers, reframing them with female protagonists. It is published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux, and I'm very pleased that it brings Rivka Galchen back to our show today. Hello.
Hi.
It would be an overstatement to say you'd based these stories on classics by Borges, Thurber, Joyce, Gogol, writings by David Foster Wallace, Haruki Murakami. How closely connected are your stories with those earlier works?
I think of it more like the kind of, you know, you have like a big meal and then you go to sleep and you have strange dreams and sort of influenced by the meal. I think of it a little bit more like that.
A couple of reviewers have described what you're doing here as riffing on these stories.
If I could play a musical instrument, I would definitely do it.
How likely would it be for a casual reader to even recognize the relationship between the stories and the ones that inspired them?
Well, some I think it's more explicit, and some I think because some of the stories that they're sort of thinking through are so famous, even if you don't notice them, you notice them. It's sort of like, even though it never happened, it's like the liminal popcorn commercial at the movie theater. You know, there are certain stories that are just deep in us, whether it's, you know, Don Quixote or Metamorphosis. Certain stories are there even when you're not picking up on it.
Do all the stories in this collection have their roots in the works of well-known male writers?
They do. But some I was more deliberate about it, and some I think it's just because, you know, as a reader, especially, you know, if you were drawn to sort of the classics, if you're kind of a good girl like me who spent your life growing up reading what you were told was really good, everything I read was really great works that happened to be 95% by men.
How did you come to wind up doing this? Did you write a story and then think, oh, this is based on what we've been talking about, and then think, well, maybe I should do some more? Or did you plan it from the start, or is this something that just kind of fell into place?
I'm a sort of very unconscious, backward person. I sort of think of it like if I had how do you grow truffles? You don't know how to grow truffles. They're wild, but you just sort of go out into the backyard and think, well, maybe they'll show up today. So I think it came about more unconsciously. I just started noticing retrospectively what I was doing. And then it became a little conscious when, like, literally for years, I had a joke with myself about The Secret Life of Willa Mitty, because I love the story of The Secret Life of Walter Mitty, and I love the stories that I think of it relating to, which would be things like, I guess the most famous one would be Cervantes, and I sort of think these characters come up again and again. They're very powerful for me, and I sort of thought, well, what would The Secret Life of Willa Mitty be? And it would be a way I would criticize myself when I would find my own internal dream space incredibly banal. And I was just, it was almost envious. I sort of thought, well, why am I sort of like thinking and worrying about these things when other people are sort of retreating into their inner space and like rescuing people and they're fighter pilots? And then I just became interested in why it wasn't obvious what The Secret Life of Willa Mitty would be as
but
a story.
It's why Thurber winds up being one of the inspirations, along with some of the most famous writers in the world, writers in a different league, as wonderful as Thurber was. When you were here to talk about Atmospheric Disturbances, you told me that you'd written the book from a male perspective because you wanted a narrator who is nothing like you. But all but two of these stories have female narrators. So what's changed?
Yeah. I mean, I think I was sort of, in a weird way, upset with myself. You know, you answer questions and you sort of find out something. I think I was, in the end, upset that when I wanted to imagine a really ridiculously confident, ridiculously certain, somewhat, like, annoying narrator,
It had to be a male.
It had to be a male. And I sort of thought, why can't it be a female? But I mean, in a sense, it's with envy. I sort of, Helen DeWitt wrote a novel, The Last Samurai, that in my mind is one of the few novels that does this with a female voice. And interestingly, you get 150 pages into the novel before you think, oh, technically this is a single mother narrative. But if you had that at the beginning of the novel, it wouldn't work.
Well, thinking about the Willa Mitty, In his New York Times review of the book on May 7th, Adam Langer suggested that these stories could be seen as fragments of a self-portrait in which you imagined alternative existences for yourself.
Yeah, you know, I do think as a writer, in a sense, I mean, where I think.
Don't all writers imagine alternative existences, or at least the ones who are not doing semi-autobiographical work?
Well, I like the quote. I think it was Fellini who said, "I could write about a fish. I'm still stuck writing about me." So, in a sense, I think I've, in a way, I'm not an autobiographical writer at all. I don't use the facts of my actual life, but I use the kind of magpie of reality around me and kind of make a nest out of it.
Your title story draws inspiration from Gogol's The Nose, but rather than waking up to discover that his nose is missing, your narrator wakes up to find that she's grown a third breast.
Yeah, you know, I wasn't sure where I got the idea for that story. And then in retrospect, I thought, oh, that's funny. I was pregnant when I wrote that story. And I did have that curious experience a lot of pregnant people have, which is that you're 9 months pregnant and no one notices. So you feel both like alienated and in a wonderful way kind of private. And I sort of think, obviously, the story is not about pregnancy, but it is. It sort of informs the kind of weird female having a body that's sort of you're not the captain of experience.
And she has mixed feelings about the third breast. Where is it?
It's on her back. It's slightly sort of on her side towards the back.
Toward the end of the story, she discovers that photos of her and the breast have been posted on the internet. Does that change how she feels about that extra breast?
I think it's like it ends up being kind of finally so distant. You know, I think her body is fairly sort of distant alien thing that's happening to her. And then it's weirdly when it's sort of made totally distant that it slightly returns to her.
Your story, The Region of Unlikeness, reimagines Borges's The Aleph. I would think that Borges would have liked a project of this sort. For himself.
When he was doing these projects, he was doing them all the time. I think it reminds me of classical ballet. Like, I've talked to a lot of dancers. Why is it that they're sort of so obsessed with classical ballet? You would think, well, maybe it would be modern. And I think it's the way that many people feel the constraint makes it so much more emotional. And so in a weird way, to enter into something that you didn't elect, to enter into a structure that pre-exists, in a weird way, although people associate that, I think, with intellectualness in a negative way, I think of it as a kind of hyper-emotional vessel.
That story involves time travel. Does this give you an opportunity to play with other kinds?
That's autobiographical.
I thought so. But it allows you to play with other kinds of genres as well. Science fiction.
Absolutely, which are their own sort of wonderful sort of constraints. And the other thing I love is they set up expectations that you can rhyme with. Like, I've always sort of envied music. It has this sort of tonic note that the listener, without realizing it, is listening for the whole time. And so you can frustrate that desire to hear the tonic. You can fulfill it. And whenever you sort of wander into any preformed structure, whether, you know, it's time travel, science fiction, or a very specific story that sets up certain expectations, it's almost as if you can make a 150-page thing only take up 10 pages because someone else has done all the setup for you to rhyme with.
My guest is Rivka Galchin, who's received numerous awards, the William Saroyan International Prize for Fiction Writing and the Rona Jaffe Foundation Writers Award. She was selected by The New Yorker for their list of 20 under 40 American fiction writers in 2010. These stories have gotten fabulous reviews, much like the reviews you received for your debut novel. Do you think of yourself as a novelist first or as a short story writer?
You know, I think at some point you just think, oh, I'm like a person who really loves words. That's the form I dream in. Because a lot of my favorite writing is nonfiction. It's just something where language is kind of what's being played with instead of image or sound.
These stories were published previously in The New Yorker, Harper's, Open City, The Walrus Magazine. But there's a note in the front of the book that says they first appeared in slightly different form. How have they changed since they were first published? Are you one of those writers who starts reading, does a reading, and then realizes in the middle of the reading, oh, gee, I shouldn't have worded it that way?
Yeah, it's so dangerous to read your things again because, of course, like, you've already become another person. So, you know, you would have written a slightly different story. But the changes are quite minor. I kind of, in a weird way, I respect that person wrote it the way they thought it should be written.
What have you changed then? Just little details. You wrote your novel and most of these stories in the first person. Obviously, you prefer doing that over the third person?
Well, there's something... It's hard to give up that wonderful, immediate gap you get with the first person. Because first person is always already somewhat wrong, just in the nature of being a first person. So, in a sense, it's hard to give up that pleasure of the reader feeling a space between what that eye says and sees and what the reader feels they're missing.
The unreliable narrator aspect,
yeah,
the first person.
Even the reliable narrators are nicely unreliable.
Well, some of your narrators seem a bit crazy, or maybe I should just say depressed. Is that how you see them? You've said that you like to see through someone else's dark glass.
Yeah, I mean, I think I have a friend who has this wonderful phrase, like, we all suffer from a mental illness of which we're the only victim. Like, you know, everyone's kind of, you know, none of us have UV light. None of us see sort of UV. There's all these things we're missing, even when we're basically in the consensus reality. So I think these characters are sort of about as wrong as the person sort of sitting next to you on the bus. But some of them are, sometimes you sit on the bus next to someone who's quite odd, and sometimes you sit on the bus next to someone who's merely kind of deformed by anger or love or whatever it might be.
Well, you went to medical school, focused on psychiatry. Do you see that as reflected in the kinds of things that you want to write about?
You know, I know
the kind of people you want to write about?
I mean, I don't think of these. I think the thing about medicine, now that I'm so far away from that training, that really stuck with me is it's this space of intimacy. It's, you know, especially like late at night, the doctor's in their pajamas, the patient's in their pajamas, people are in a kind of extreme. You're not in the hospital because it's an ordinary day of your life. And that kind of proximity to a stranger, that's the thing I really carry over into my fiction.
Was your mother disappointed that you didn't become a doctor?
Well, why wouldn't she be? It's great to be a doctor.
But you've had success as a writer. Has that made it any easier to accept?
I can't speak for her. But I, you know, now, especially now that I've been a writer for a while, I think to myself, I understand why people want their children to be doctors and lawyers. It's totally understandable.
You've been teaching at Columbia's MFA program. Do you have the summer off?
I do, yes.
Some writers dislike teaching. They'd rather be able to write full-time if they could. Others have told me that they really enjoy teaching because they like that interaction with the students, and sometimes they're even inspired by their students.
I think of it as a sort of really positive, mild crisis. There's a sort of panic right before class, and the class is itself a slightly pressured situation where you don't want to waste everyone else's time. That everyone's sort of in a weird way. I almost exclusively teach seminars, so I think of it as this really lucky thing. It's just like every week I've coerced 20 people into reading a book I love and talking about it.
What's next, another novel or more short stories? Or do you write the short stories all along while you're working on a novel?
I think I'm working on a novel, but I thought I was working on a novel before.
Rivka Galchin's latest book, American Innovations, is published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux. Thank you so much for being on our show again.
Thank you.